Not a con.
Good afternoon. My name is Mike Tetralt. I'm going to speak to you on threat modeling. Originally, my presentation was going to consist of two parts, threat modeling and a demonstration of what happens if you don't mitigate the threats. Unfortunately, I managed to pretty much destroy the virtual machine that I had planned on using as a demonstration by using Retina against it and cranking it up just a little too hard. So instead, I'm going to be doing a little bit more expanded presentation on threat modeling and the threat modeling process. I guess the best way to introduce it is what it is. Simply put, it's a framework for improving the security of applications and infrastructure. It provides a way of analyzing what are the threats, what are the risks against those threats, and what are the consequences if those threats are not mitigated. What it is not. What it is not is, it's not a silver bullet. It will not fix all of your security woes. It is not the holy grail of security. It's several steps in the right direction, but taken by itself, it's not sufficient to mitigate all risks. Traditionally, security has fallen to the backside. After analysis and design have been done, and after code has already started, people start thinking to themselves, wow, maybe we should consider security of the application here. And by that point, it's either too late or too expensive to put it in for those things that do need to be mitigated. It's cost prohibitive. By doing it up front and by baking it in as part of the process, it makes it much easier to swallow rather than having the fire drill at the end, or worse, after it's already out and released and having a vulnerability put out on you. This presentation is solely an introduction. The actual process itself is very involved. The process, as outlined, is fairly extensive and really can't be covered even in a two-hour session here. What I'm going to give you today is the benefits and a high-level overview of what it does. But as far as the how, that's something that you guys need to research on your own. Let's talk a little bit about traditional security analysis, how it's done. The typical way is you have your annual rate of occurrence times your single loss expectancy brings about your annual loss expectancy. Basically, that's how often it'll happen, how much you will lose when it happens equals how much you will lose per year from it. Unfortunately, that doesn't take a lot of things into account. There are things that simply can't be quantified in that. Damage to reputation. If a financial services company has a online brokerage site that gets hacked, that's obviously going to be a lot more costly than the financial losses incurred and the regulatory penalties assigned for it. There's going to be a tremendous loss of consumer confidence in that company. Another traditional tool is the code review. I don't know how many of you guys are developers within the corporate realm, but those of you that are have almost undoubtedly been through the code review process for at least some of your code. They're slow, they're tedious, they're moderately effective in most cases. Some cases they're not effective at all. It comes down to you have to be able to figure out what code is it that you need to analyze and look at in depth. You need to focus the efforts on those pieces, not lose sight of anything, because if you lose track of even one line of code within those critical components, you can leave a very serious vulnerability in there. one example of why a code review is not an effective tool by itself is looking at an authentication mechanism. What a code review can tell you about looking at your authentication mechanism is whether it is secure or not, and whether it performs securely inside of itself. What the code review cannot tell you, however, is whether the security level of that code, the authentication code, meets the needs of what the application has. That's a byproduct of the code review not being an integrated part of the process. What threat modeling does is it integrates the code and the security requirements into a cohesive unit to allow for managing the entire process. Another failing of the code review is that it's not really appropriate for infrastructure level code. Code reviews are really best for very small, very defined, very critical structures within code. State machines, session handling, things like that. Places where an attacker is going to try to subvert the code. Where it's not so good is in dealing with large infrastructure type things. You have hundreds of thousands, if not millions of lines of code in core applications. There's simply too much there to be able to effectively go through in a code review, no matter how large the scope of it is. An example of this is looking at a session handler. A session handler has security requirements both within the context of an application and within the context of itself. In doing a code review, you're typically only going to be looking at it within the context of itself. You'll be overlooking architectural issues such as having identifiers that can be guessed, which would allow you to predict who the next person is going to be. I believe it was the Guess Genes website had predictable identifiers, and basically people were able to view other people's information on them, and they ended up getting a very severe fine from the FTC, and they actually have ongoing monitoring of their internet operations. They have to have them reviewed by the FTC for, I believe it was 20 or 25 years. I don't know how long that's going to hold up, but that's what was originally imposed. Obviously, they were spanked pretty hard. Another thing that a code review is not going to find is a replay vulnerability. If I know what somebody else's session identifier is, if that request is not authenticated, then I can pretend to be that user. A code review is not going to, you're not going to have the requirement come out of a code review or have it enforced that all requests be authenticated. That's an infrastructure thing. That's something that's simply outside the scope of most code reviews. Another type of attack that would likely escape most code reviews is injection, basically by putting in arbitrary code to a session identifier. You can potentially, assuming it's not boundary checked, expose a vulnerability within your database engine, for instance, if that's where your state session is kept. One of the failings of code review in that would be that even though boundary checking may be in place, what would not be in place is a knowledge of what is the state engine going to be behind the scenes there. What is it that this particular session server needs to be on the lookout for to keep out of the state engine? What code review tools can tell you is whether or not a string is being operated against without having the boundaries checked first. That's very simple for any of the automated code review tools out there to do. One of the things that's more difficult for them to do is to identify an overflow because a function is looping and copying into that string. If that string length is a fixed length, I'm not aware of any code review tools out there that will automatically catch that. Classic buffer overflow in action right there. Application security lifecycle. Basically, we have seven steps here. The steps feed one into the other, although some of the steps will feed back into previous steps. It's not just 1 to 2 to 3 to 4, so on and so forth. as we discuss steps that feed back to each other, I'll point that out to you. Beginning with gathering requirements, that's where the security work of an application needs to begin, is at the very upfront stages. By having security be a consideration in the process from the requirement stage on forward, it's much easier to make changes to affect the security of an application. If something is found to be unsecure, or if it's not secure enough, it's very easy to make a change at this stage of a project to increase or change the security to a level that it needs to be. Once you're into implementation and deployment, obviously the cost is much, much higher. Some of the considerations that you need to take into account when gathering requirements as far as security goes are, what is the deployment environment? Is this something that's meant for the small office or home user, or is this something that's meant for corporations, or is this meant for an organization that has higher security requirements than that, something like a military application, for instance? You need to keep in mind who your audience is for the product in order to effectively drive security requirements for it. Customer expectations. Customer expectations are also very important as well. If it's a product that's being pitched as a security product, you better have your product secure. If the app is responsible for critical business infrastructure, obviously, if your application is going to be put into, is serving a need that is a critical underpinning of a business operation, it's going to be one of the first places that hackers are going to go after. Another consideration is it widely deployed? Is this something that only a few thousand people would have use for, or is this something that's going to be the next Microsoft Word? If it's something that everybody's going to be using, what type of files do you use? Are the files that you use within the application generally regarded as secure, like JPEG files? Sure, most of us are aware of the GDI vulnerability in the JPEG handling. One final consideration on this is whether the product is being positioned as being more secure than the competitors. That's up to those marketing people. Who knows what they're going to do. But if they do start saying that, you better make sure that it is more secure. And in order to do that, you have to get the security baked in up front. securing the design. During the design stage, you start taking the requirements and putting them to paper, coming up with what is the final product going to look like. What is it going to look like? What does it need to do? Security should be a consideration there too. Your design must incorporate security concerns, otherwise, again, you're going to be scrambling at the end to try to backfill it. In your design, you may not be able to account for all potential risks. You may have external dependencies. Some of those external dependencies may be single points of failure. It's one of the requirements of having a secure design to be able to get around that and to deal with that in a secure fashion. One of the things that you need to get into the developers' minds as you start doing your design is that the only consideration is not scalability versus performance. Security is something that needs to be considered in there as well. Threat modeling and architecture review. Threat modeling can begin in earnest, the actual process of it, once your product is feature complete. Once you know what it is that the product is going to do, you can begin driving out how the security is put into that. It becomes much more physical and much less theoretical at this stage. One of the critical components of doing the threat modeling at this stage is knowing what your inputs and outputs are. What are the entry points to the application? What are the exit points? And also the transfer points within the application as well. If you have a distributed architecture, of let's say you've got a three-tier system. You don't just need to be concerned about what's going on tier one, you need to be concerned about the entries to tiers 1, 2, and 3. Code review. Code review is most effective if it's initiated as sections of the code go code complete. Reviewing code that's still subject to change or is not feature complete yet is a recipe for disaster. What's going to happen is you will review code and the code will change after it's already been signed off on as being secure code, and it won't be once in the final product. One of the advantages of using threat modeling in the process is that it allows you to analyze the overall architecture of an application and come up with what are the critical pieces that need to have the low-level analysis done with them. Where are the efforts as far as doing a code review best spent? Things like your session engine, your state engine, your authentication mechanism. Those are going to be the critical points that people are going to attack first. They're the soft, vulnerable part of the application. It's your job to make sure that they're protected as best as possible. Using threat modeling allows you to drive out what are those parts. Penetration testing. In addition to the standard hire somebody to come in for a few days and poke around and see, jiggle the door handle, see if they can open anything up. Other things to consider as far as this stage of the life cycle go are, what are some products that are similar to the one that we're creating? Have those products had vulnerabilities found within them? If so, are we at risk for those same vulnerabilities as well? Another thing to think about is third-party libraries that your application may use. If those third-party libraries are vulnerable, then your application is vulnerable too. Securing deployment. One of the trade-offs that developers need to, and project teams in general, need to face within the dev cycle is what's the most appropriate way of securing an application. One of the problems with that is that the most appropriate way of securing an application may not necessarily be the best way of securing it. A classic example of this is the radical change in how Microsoft products are installed by default. You look back at SQL 6.5, the SA password was blank by default. Nowadays, if you want to have a blank SA password, you have to go through a couple of prompts that say, you know, this really is not a very good idea. That's an example of an implementation or a deployment consideration. There are some instances where the most secure deployment may not work for a large portion of your customers. In order to deal with that, it's crucial that any security features of a product be well documented. Integrating feedback into the lifecycle. Once a product has been released, obviously you're going to be receiving feedback, both from customers saying, I wish it would, to customers saying, it really shouldn't, to anyone and everyone saying, you know, this is actually a pretty big risk here. One of the things as a dev team you need to do is have a process in place following release of your product to integrate the feedback either into the next version or into any patches that you need to issue. You have four primary roles that are involved in application security. The first role that I'm going to discuss here is the architects. They are the ones that design the foundation of the system. Obviously, given that they're the ones that are creating the blueprints for an application, having their involvement with security practices is very important. By having them involved, you can head off a lot of risks and a lot of headaches that you may run into later on. Developers, obviously, they're the doers. They're the ones that do the code, that make the magic happen. They're also the ones that have the most intimate knowledge of the technical aspects of an application. As a result of that, they're also one of the primary sources of information as far as the threat modeling process goes. Not only are they one of the primary sources of information, they're also one of the primary consumers, because they're the ones that are going to implement the changes that that come out of the threat modeling process. Testers. Most organizations that I've had experience in, testers have been fairly isolated from the development process. If involved at all, they've been involved very far on the backside after everything is code complete. That's not the best way of driving out security. Having testers involved throughout the process allows the testers to become a questioner as far as the application and the infrastructure of that application goes. They can be a counterbalance. They're an outside party from the dev team. They're not involved with the development of it. By taking that role and not just making sure that the functional requirements of an application are met, they can help drive out security. Management's critical in application security. They're the ones who have to answer the question of how much money can we spend and how much time can we take in making our application or product secure. One of their responsibilities is demonstrating the return on investment for any of the security work. They're the ones that are ultimately accountable for the security of the application. So now that we've covered a background, we're ready to get into what is threat modeling. There are three main parts to it: understanding the adversary's view, characterizing the security of the system, and determining the threats to that system. As far as understanding the adversary's view goes, you have entry points, assets, and trust levels. Entry points, fairly obvious. Any location where data or control transfers between the system being modeled and another system. Another way of looking at that is, how can an adversary interface with my system? An application can't be attacked unless an adversary has a way of interacting with it. An example of that is, I don't know how many of you remember Microsoft proudly proclaiming that NT4 is C2 compliant. Well, yes, it is. It could be made C2 compliant. It certainly was not out of the box by installation defaults. Some of the things you had to do as far as making it C2 compliant were to remove the network adapter and either remove or epoxy the any sort of removable storage. So, sure, it's C2 compliant, but that's because there's no entry points at all to the system. Assets. What are the resources or components of a system that an attacker is going to go after? It's impossible to have a threat without a corresponding asset, because the asset is the threat target. Assets are both tangible and intangible. You can have tangible assets like a process token or a database table, but you can also have intangible assets, things like data consistency and relational integrity. If you can affect an application at that level, then you definitely have the ability to wreak havoc within the application. Defining use scenarios. I don't know how many of you guys are familiar with UML and use cases and all of that good stuff. Threat modeling takes use cases into account and uses them as an input to the process. Basically, what the use scenarios cover is how and why will a component be used. One of the things to think about in that is also, in addition to how and why it will be used, is how will it not be used, and how should it not be used. Identifying assumptions and dependencies. The dev team is responsible for collecting information about things like external dependencies, implementation assumptions, security notes, any sort of information, security-related information for third-party components that are used as part of the application. When looking at external dependencies, what is important here is documenting the security of the other systems that can affect the security of the system that you're working on. In a nutshell, if you're depending on something that's vulnerable, and that's an integral part of your application, you're vulnerable too. Implementation assumptions are important to gather as part of this because they are what developers keep in mind as far as security, designing the security of an application goes. If it's assumed that an application is going to require transporting data over a public network, then obviously the security requirements are very different than transporting totally non-sensitive information across a customer's own network. Modeling the system. Modeling the system is where you get Visio out and start cranking out things like data flow diagrams, visual representations of how the system processes data, what your process boundaries are, what the different components are, and how they talk with each other. Having a clear, documented understanding of how does this application interact not only with other applications but within itself is critical to maintain the security, because if you don't have a firm grasp of what an application does, it's possible that it's doing something you're not aware of and are not taking into consideration in mitigating risk. Some of the questions that you want to answer out of modeling your system include things like, how are protected resources affected? If somebody does nasty things here, what is the risk over here? Where could an external entity manipulate an asset? How deeply can somebody reach into the system? An example of that is the classic SQL injection. A user from a remote internet user is reaching not only to your web server but into your database server. What processing occurs beyond an entry point? What happens to input from a user once it enters the realm of the system? Is all data boundary checked prior to being brought any further into the system? What action is taken on behalf of the external entity? What types of things can a user request initiate? Something that may not be obvious to a user. They may not even realize it. Just a simple example of, let's say you have like a Flickr site, for instance, and you're going and you're uploading your pictures. Most people aren't going to think that when I upload my picture, I'm writing something to a file system somewhere. If the Flickr folks hadn't thought of that, I'm sure somebody else will think of it for them. One final question to answer as far as modeling the system is, what transformations performed on the data supplied? What this speaks to is taking input from a user, and are we putting it into a buffer? And if we're putting it into a buffer, is that buffer sized appropriately? Is there a risk or a potential for a buffer overflow to take place because we're trying to put too much information in too small space? Identifying threats. After you've cataloged your entry points up front there, what you do at this stage is to look at the entry points and determine how might somebody try to do something here. What might they try to do? Obviously, you're going to have very different thoughts on that within a form in a web application. For a public-facing website that users are putting information on that they're not authenticated first, versus an extranet application that is exposed solely to business partners that has strong authentication required to access it. Your security requirements are very different in each case. The one way of classifying the threats is by breaking them down into general classifications. One way of doing that is the STRIDE model. STRIDE is an acronym standing for spoofing, tampering, repudiation, information disclosure, denial of service, and elevation of privileges. Some attacks cross multiple, or some attacks fall into multiple categories, but the STRIDE model provides one way of cataloging vulnerabilities. After you've identified threats through the threat modeling process, you can begin to analyze them to see what needs to be done to mitigate them, whether it should be done, and what are the risks if it's not done. Threat modeling provides you a means of quantifying in a very firm way what are the risks and what can happen. One of the underlying thoughts of threat modeling is that things follow one another. It's impossible to have a threat without an asset. So therefore, threats and assets are linked. And in fact, within threat modeling, you use numerical identifiers to link them to one another. After you've cataloged your threats, you create threat trees. Threat trees are what you use to determine the vulnerabilities of a system. Threat trees can take a threat and decompose it into testable conditions. If I do this, then I should get this. If I do this, then I should not get this. It's the threat tree where you break your threats down into the condition checks. threats within threat modeling are classified by an acronym called DREAD. Damage potential, reproducibility, exploitability, affected users, and I'm gonna have to cheat here, discoverability. Basically, by looking at each of those five pieces of information and assigning a value to it, typically low, medium, and high, what it gives is the ability to determine what is the risk of this threat. And if this threat is not mitigated, what happens? What's the exposure? An unmitigated threat is what becomes a vulnerability. Keys to threat modeling success. There are a number of recommended best practices as far as threat modeling goes. One of the most universal ones is start the process early. Threat modeling relies on gathering information and pulling it together. If you are gathering that information all along in the process, it's a lot easier than scrambling to find it and hoping you didn't miss anything. By doing it early and continuously, you lessen the chances of overlooking any critical pieces of information. By meeting on a regular basis, you keep security in the minds of the project team. Without meeting on a regular basis, what tends to happen is that security slips by the wayside, is forgotten, and at the end, prior to implementation, everybody starts running around trying to figure out what do we need to do. By meeting regularly throughout the development process, you can hopefully bypass that last minute fire drill. By including people that have security background but don't necessarily have an in-depth knowledge of a system, it allows you to get a second opinion. They don't have, they're not so close to the situation that they're able to overlook things that, they see things that people that are deeply involved may not see. Documenting offline is something that's important. Threat models for complex application can reach into the hundreds of pages and have dozens of diagrams and drawings. It's not really an efficient use of anyone's time to be sitting in a meeting creating Visio drawings to insert into the threat model. It's important to update parts of the document during the meetings by including notes within the living document as you're meeting about it. It allows you to not forget something that came up. You're not supposed to sit there and dutifully note everything and spell check and grammar check everything, just enough that to jog your memory when you're going back to actually complete the threat model document. There are some parts that should be done prior to any meetings, though, things that have inputs from information gathered since the previous meeting should be completed before the regular meeting so that they can be built off of. One of the things that threat modeling requires is building layer upon layer upon layer upon layer. You start with what are the risks, and you take it from there. One of the things that will make the meetings go a lot more smoothly is not letting the discussion spin out of control into what do we do to fix this. That's the developer's jobs to figure that out. Where you need to focus the regular meetings on is what are the threats, and how are we going to what sort of risk level are we going to assign to them? That's how the output of the meeting can be given to the developers, so that they can actually implement and mitigate risks identified. One of the important things is to keep in mind is who the audience for the threat model is. Managers need to be able to review a threat model document and be able to understand that this system is secure, and that if there are risks present in the system, what are those risks and what is the exposure of those risks. Testers need to be able to understand it so that they can construct the tests necessary to do the condition checks to make sure that this vulnerability is indeed mitigated. Security review teams need to be able to understand the document to the point that they can say, yes, this application is secure, or yes, this application is secure, but there are risks present, and here are those risks. Threat modeling is not about closing off any risks present in an application. It's about cataloging and mitigating those that need to be mitigated. Some additional keys to creating effective threat models is understanding what the difference is between a feature level and an application level threat model. Working on feature level threat models is much more involved and reaches much more deeply into an application than an application threat model. Feature-level threat models are useful in cases where you need to pay special attention to what are the risks of this. Examples of that, stuff like authentication and authorization mechanisms, things that you would do a code review on, you probably want to do a feature-level threat model on. Choosing the appropriate level for the threat model for an application. In a perfect world, the threat model would be as granular as necessary to mitigate any and all risk to an application. Obviously, we don't have all the time in the world to devote to security for our applications, so you need to make trade-offs. You need to be careful about cutting it too close and working at too high of a level and not looking at enough of your components, because if you don't, obviously you run the risk of leaving something open that really should be closed. If you have minimal time to focus on security, you want to focus that security on your input points. What are the entry points to an application? Whether it's a web application that has forms that take form posts, you want to do your boundary checking on those, on the inputs from that. If you have more time, great, start digging deeper. Some investigations as far as looking at security are best performed with a code review. It's difficult to do a code review for an entire application, but it's much easier to do it for the critical pieces of that application, things that accept input, things that determine access levels, things that divide information between users. If you use an object to hold user state, then obviously you want that to be as secure as possible. Where a code review is useful as well is in analyzing very complex pieces of code where it's possible that a developer overlooked something that needs to be in there. Some code is more complex than others. The more complex it is, the easier it is to forget something. And if something's forgotten, then the possibility exists that a vulnerability has been inserted because of that. By doing a thorough code review of those complex sections of code, it allows you to mitigate that risk. Code reviews are also helpful when the threat is implementation related and would be countered by secure development practices. Let's face it, not all developers are security experts. Hell, very few of them are. But there are patterns and procedures out there for developers to use as guidelines for writing secure code. Don't accept input blindly. Don't check the length of an input before putting it into a fixed length buffer. I mean, things that should be common sense but aren't. Code reviews allow you to check up on the developers and make sure that such details are in place. Security pushes. Most of you guys probably remember the recent push by Microsoft where we're putting development on hold for 6 months while we send developers scurrying through their code to make sure that it's secure. We mean it this time. If the application's threat model is at a very high level, looking at only the most basic of things that it needs to, then having a security push may be useful for that application. In doing so, investigation of security of the application should be put off until such time that the code is feature and code complete. Basically, the code is frozen. Okay, let's take a look at it. This is not the time to be making any sort of bug fixes or feature changes. Focus solely on security. one of the risks of relying on a security push to put security into an application is that the features won't be complete and that the timeline will not allow for a full breadth of security push to take place. I'm sure we've all run into circumstances where you're working on a project and requirements aren't solid and they're ever changing, and you bump up against implementation and you have to choose between, well, do we make it work or do we fully stress test it? When doing a security push at prior to implementation of an application, that's not a choice you can make. It's not acceptable to say, well, we need to implement a few more features, so we'll just cut down the time for this security push. Hey guys, what's that noise? It's just a little noise every now and then, but it seems to be getting more frequent. Okay, just keep an eye on it. Penetration testing. Penetration testing can be used to investigate threats for application level threat models. What you do in a penetration test, obviously, is you simulate what is an adversary's view of this application. You can use either you have two approaches you can use to penetration testing. Either you can give the pen testers full access to the system's documentation and architecture so that they have a lot more knowledge than an average tester would, or you can just turn them loose on it black box. Both approaches have their pros and cons. One example, one time when penetration testing is an appropriate security measure is when it's too costly in terms of either time or money to do a full code review of an application. A lot of times you have big applications that you simply can't do a full code review on. Focus in on the critical parts of the application and let the penetration testing deal with the rest of it. When you have to make trade-offs between what features are incorporated in the threat model, you want to focus in on your critical pieces. Critical pieces include sections of your application that handle access control. What is a user allowed to do and what are they not allowed to do? Obviously, if somebody can attack your access control mechanism, they can either impersonate another user or impersonate a system administrator. Auditing and logging. Having solid auditing and logging is critical to calling an application secure. If a user can maliciously attack an application, or if they are able to jiggle the handles on the doors to see if they're unlocked without being logged and audited, that's going to be a problem. An example of that is within a Windows system, you have the security log, and the security log can audit all sorts of information. But one of the things that you can do is you can make the system shut down if the security log fills up. What this does is it ensures that nothing will be lost as far as security details go. But one of the drawbacks of that is that if you're not paying attention to your security log and it fills up, well, your system's not available to the users until it's cleared. Authentication. you need to provide strong identification of the users. If there's any holes at all within the authentication mechanism, the entire application is vulnerable. Data formatting and protocol parsing. What this covers is what is it that handles input from the users or from the network? And do the components that handle those parts of the application have the security put into them to meet the challenge of dealing with that input? Is it secure, or could somebody put in 1,025 characters into what was designed as a 1K buffer? Sandboxes. If an application uses a sandbox of any kind, assumption number one is that anything going on in the sandbox is deemed unsecure. Assumption number two, and the one that you need to test and be indubitable of, is that anything going on in the sandbox cannot escape the sandbox. Classic example of that is Microsoft's JVM. Back when they first came out with it, it seemed as if every 2 weeks they were coming up with some new way of breaking out of the sandbox that the JVM provided. Skipped one. Permissions. Pretty straightforward. Granting or denying a user privileges within a system. You got to be sure that your permissions are strongly enforced and that they're done in a secure fashion. Session management. You need to make sure that the session management is every bit as secure as your initial user authentication. If the session management system is vulnerable to any sort of replay attack or any other kind of hijacking, then you've essentially invalidated your authentication system, because a user can impersonate any other user. State machines. The state machines are an example of a state machine is requiring a user to log on prior to accessing an application. If your state machine is vulnerable and subject to manipulation, the example that I gave, you could access the application without having first logged on to the system. Obviously, state machine is something that you need to be sure is secure. Additional things to making the threat modeling process as effective as possible. Clearly defining roles and responsibilities. This is important on two fronts. By ensuring that the roles and responsibilities are clearly defined, you eliminate any potential of turf wars between this is my job, and having unproductive efforts because of that. What you also eliminate is the risk that things will be done multiple times by different people to different standards. By having the roles and responsibilities clearly outlined, it provides the structure necessary to carry it out effectively. determining which applications to model. Threat modeling is a good tool, but not all applications need to have threat modeling applied to them. Small internal applications that deal with no sensitive information and not part of a business critical infrastructure, that's not something that you necessarily need to put the full security process to. Anything that deals with the public or has remote anonymous users or encompasses functionality that is business critical, those are the things that you need to look at and that you need to ensure that the security is very strong on. You need to know whether you're modeling a server or a client-based application. The simplest way of explaining the difference is that a server-based application is something like a web server and a site contained on that web server. Client-based application is something like, we'll throw out Word as an example, your word processor. Your client application requires the user to take action, to make an active role in any sort of risk that may be there. Something like the bazillion worms or bazillion Trojans out there that that mass email everybody in your contact list and send them to everybody there. Those take a user action, opening an attachment. One of the things to consider in looking at a client-based threat model is that there are some things that users can, and unfortunately will, do that make things inherently unsecure. You need to make sure that you recognize any such behavior as being out of bounds for the threat model. There's only so much that you can control. You hand somebody a knife, most people aren't going to stab themselves, but somebody might try, and you've got to say it's not your fault. Even if you are dealing with client-based things, you can't protect users from their own actions. But by the same token, you do have a responsibility to protect users from the actions of others. An example would be the Office document macro viruses that were all the rage a couple of years ago. They were successful because when a user opened a document, arbitrary code was executed. To mitigate that vulnerability, what Microsoft did was create trust levels as far as code goes. And if a document has a macro in it, you will be warned, hey, this document has a macro. Do you really want to execute this? Unfortunately, some users think that's okay, but that's one case where the risk was addressed. Basically, the client app is doing something that it shouldn't have been allowed to do. In order to consider a threat model complete, it needs to resolve all threats. Resolving a threat does not necessarily mean that it has been sealed off or fixed. It simply means that it has been acknowledged. Some vulnerabilities are not critical enough to be closed or do not have enough of an impact if they are exploited. They're not closed, but they are resolved. They're basically accepted. If a threat is unresolved, then the security of a system can't be quantified. As I said before, threat modeling relies on the allows for the quantification of the security of a system. If a threat has not been fully explored and acknowledged, then the threat model is not complete and the security is not quantifiable. Reviewing the threat model. A threat model, like anything else, is best accepted once it's been reviewed by peers. Having coworkers or other people involved in your industry review the threat model allows you to take their comments into consideration and use that for further refining the model itself. Additional outputs of reviewing the threat model include ensuring that the model is consistent. If you've chosen to implement a feature-level model, having the document, having your threat model reviewed, allows you to ensure that you've maintained a consistent focus, a consistent level of detail throughout the document. That's not to say that you can't put more detail into your high-risk areas of the application. But it is to say that you've been consistent throughout in looking at everything. It also ensures the quality of the threat model itself and provides feedback to the team that created the threat model. We learn by doing and receiving feedback from those things that we do. That's what allows us to create better stuff. Anytime that functionality is added, changed, or removed, you need to go back and revisit your threat model. Anytime that any of your inputs change, you have to go back and revisit your threat model. A threat model is not a deliverable of a project and it's done. A threat model is and should be a living document that changes over time as the application changes. It should be considered an integral part of the application's documentation. How to make it work. Now, you got some practical considerations to take into account. You need to plan, document, schedule, and determine. Planning means dedicating time to the threat modeling process in the project's life cycle. Just like any other task within a project, threat modeling is something that needs to have time allocated to it. Time and resources allocated to it as part of the project plan. Threat models can be used to design the security test plans. That's where the testers, that's where the output of the threat modeling team is used by the testers to create the condition checks to make sure that any risks that were mitigated as part of the security review
have in fact been mitigated in the final product. Documenting. As I said before, threat models should be considered an integral part of the documentation of an application. Any changes in the application need to be integrated into the threat model. If the threat model and the application fall out of sync with one another, it will require a lot of effort to bring it back up to where it was. It's a lot easier to make those incremental changes rather than doing it as making the changes in a generational type process. Scheduling. Not every project can afford the time or the money that it takes to do a full-blown threat model. That's why one of the things that you do up front is decide what type of model you want to use. That's what allows you to put into the project plan, the threat model will take this much time and require this many resources. By focusing on solely the high-risk points of the application, you cut down on the time and money involved in scheduling the threat modeling within the project plan. The costs of fixing security issues within a project are usually measured in man months. When a security issue is caught early and upfront in a project, it may be as simple as making a change to a drawing on a whiteboard. When a security issue is identified in a product that has already been pressed to 300,000 CDs, obviously it's going to require a much higher cost to mitigate that risk. Some of the things that need to be considered as far as costs of implementing a security fix go, assuming you're doing it late in your development cycle because security work hasn't been done throughout the process, you have to take into account how much is it going to cost to distribute a patch to the users. A lot of that has been driven down lately because we have this whole internet thing that we can go and download things from instead of having to receive a CD from a vendor or a floppy. You have costs that are incurred by your customers as far as what it costs for them to fix your crap. If you left a vulnerability in there, they're the ones that have to go in and clean it up. If you have 500 Microsoft servers that are vulnerable to the latest MS-05 whatever, it's going to take time, and time is money to fix that. You need to include that cost as far as your cost model goes. You have intangible costs as well. Consumer dissatisfaction, damage to company reputation. Those can be very high costs to endure. Revisiting the threat model. I said before that the threat model needs to change as the application changes. Some things that are critical to include in a threat model aren't necessarily going to be known until you reach your implementation. after you've encountered those things, they need to be brought back into the threat model. They need to be incorporated into it. Just as implementing a single security feature into an application will not make that application secure, creating a threat model and not updating it will not make that application secure either. Once you enter into the maintenance phase of an application, it becomes especially important to impress upon the development and the support teams that it's very important to update the threat model. Anybody who's worked development before knows the mentality difference between project-focused development and application support. It's critical to impress upon the support folks that this is not something that only the project folks do. This is something you guys do also. You can go out and buy help on securing an application or infrastructure or whatever it is you're working on. Typically, vendors can provide you with either a code review or penetration testing or both. When evaluating a vendor for any security services, be sure that you're clear on what their procedures are. There are a lot out there that have a very haphazard approach, and it's up to a lot is left to the individual's discretion as far as how to carry out the penetration test. You may get lucky, you may get one of the good guys. You may get unlucky, you may get somebody that just started doing it 2 months ago. By working with a vendor who has procedures in place, it ensures consistency across any of the folks that will be dealing with your application. As far as managing the threat modeling process, like I said, it should begin up front when you're doing your requirements gathering. As you move through your application life cycle, the work effort involved in threat modeling and also the importance of it increase. You work at a very different depth level in threat modeling from between requirements gathering and when you're actually doing your development. The inputs to the threat model are very different. They come from very different people. When you're doing your implementation or your development work, a lot of your inputs are coming from the developers. When you're doing your requirements, they're coming from your system analysts. Large initiatives will require a different approach. You can't really have one team that overall is responsible for the entire threat model. Just like large projects are divided into sub-projects or work areas or what have you, so too should the threat model be divided between them. This is easily accomplished because the threat model focuses on what are the inputs and what are the outputs of the application being modeled. So just because the modeling is being done by different teams doesn't mean that it's any less secure. As far as what kind of, how much time to allocate to the threat model, there's a lot of questions that need to be considered. How complex is the application? If the application is very complex, then obviously it's going to require a much more extensive threat modeling. How much risk does the application face? Is this something that's public-facing, or is this something that's just meant to operate standalone on a home user's PC? Does the app listen on a network? If it listens on a network, obviously you're going to need to be much more careful as far as your inputs go, because your inputs could be anyone. Does the app accept input from high-risk sources? It's the difference between a VPN server that allows next to nothing until the user authenticates against it versus a publicly accessible web application, which allows input from anyone and everyone. Does the application protect valuable resources? I mean, are we storing grandma's recipes here, or are we storing her banking records? Obviously, the level of effort put into threat modeling is very different between the two. Is security under particular scrutiny? Has the application's competitors have they had vulnerabilities found within their system? If they have, obviously you want to make sure that you're not vulnerable to those same things, and people will be looking for it. One important thing to keep in mind as far as updating the threat model goes is that if you rely on anything, any components underneath you, any changes in those need to be incorporated as well. If you're relying on third-party components to perform critical pieces of your application and those components change, then your threat model must be readdressed as well. I'd like to leave you with a couple of final thoughts here. Security of an application cannot be understood or validated unless quantified in a threat model document. Parenthetical note should be in there, in a completed threat model document. Every legitimate security feature counters one or more threats to the system. Just because something is really cool security doesn't mean that it's necessary if there isn't a threat that it counters. Reliability of software impacts business continuity. If your application's vulnerable and it handles business critical stuff, you will hear about it. You haven't experienced fun until you've had to listen to the line of business folks screaming at you about, why isn't my system working? Not that I've ever heard that. Public networks are becoming increasingly hostile as new techniques are discovered. 5 years ago, cross-site scripting wasn't even on the radar, at least as far as I'm aware. Now it's something that you need to watch for in any sort of web application that you do. Any level of security analysis is better than none at all. Even if you're simply eyeballing your application and asking the questions, is this doing what it needs to do? Is this ensuring that things that shouldn't happen are not allowed to happen? That's better than doing nothing at all. Any questions? Any legitimate questions? Do you want one where a vulnerability was found after the fact or where it was found during the dev cycle? Okay, during the dev cycle. Let's say we're in user acceptance testing and users are loose on the system, and just to try to break it, they're doing all sorts of stupid things like putting in their name in the zip code field. And wow, this is doing something it shouldn't do. Well, they feed that back to the project team. The project team has, assuming that a system architect is still involved in the project at that point, they would likely be the ones to go to the threat modeling team. Threat modeling team consisting of senior developers, system architect, assuming the organization has any sort of a security team in place, obviously there would be representation from that team. They would go to the threat modeling team and assess, okay, we found a threat here. We have a field that accepts input that it shouldn't. What can you do with that? What can you access with that? What is the risk of it being exploited? that would fall to however your post-implementation support is structured. At that point, the project team doesn't really exist anymore, assuming it's not immediately post-implementation. Right. Well, obviously they need to assess the what is the risk of waiting to fix this. I'll ask a question back. Does project lifecycle include the maintenance phase? That's why it's important to make sure that your support folks are aware that any sort of changes that are made as part of break fix need to be reflected in the threat model. Even especially if those changes have anything to do with entry points to an application. There is no threat model team. At that point, the threat model document is already in place, and it's simply a matter of making changes to that document. Any other questions? Thank you very much.